This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
By any standards, Edward the Confessor lived a remarkable life and left a still more remarkable legacy. He was a central figure in a period of turbulent politics, characterised by factional intrigue, rebellion, invasion and conquest. He personally experienced dramatic reversals in fortune, spending 25 years in exile, before reigning as King of England for almost as long, through periods of triumph and humiliation. His life was shaped by some of the great warlords of the age, but also by some astonishingly resourceful women. Queens were just as important as kings in shaping Edward's career. His posthumous life was similarly eventful. His death triggered the sequence of events that led to the Norman conquest, and his place of burial, Westminster Abbey, became the focal point of a cult, which eventually made Edward the patron saint of the English monarchy, and the Abbey a national treasure. Edward was born at Islip in Oxfordshire between 1003 and 1005. The reign of his father, King Athelred the Unready, was plagued by Viking invasion. Indeed, Edward owed his very existence to the threat they posed. The Vikings used the coastline of northern France as launch pads for assaults on England, and to prevent this, Athelred formed an alliance with Richard, Duke of Normandy, by marrying his daughter Emma in 1002. Edward was born shortly afterwards. Little is known about Edward's childhood, except that he grew up in a kingdom pounded by intense Viking activity, which culminated in the conquest of England by King Swain of Denmark in 1013. This forced Athelred to seek refuge in Normandy with Emma and their children. But Swain died unexpectedly in February 1014, whereupon Athelred sent Edward to deliver a message to the English nobility, promising that he would be a gracious lord to them and reform all the things which they had hated. Athelred was duly restored to power, but he then died on the 23rd of April 1016, in the middle of a period of desperate campaigning, which led to Canute's conquest of England that year, and Edward was forced to return to exile in Normandy with his younger brother, Alfred. This time he remained in exile for 25 years and did not enjoy the comfort of his mother's protection. Norman sources claim that Edward was welcomed and honoured by Duke Richard and his successors. Now, since these sources were written later to justify and legitimate the Norman conquest, their testimony must be treated with caution. But they received strong support from five charters issued by Norman dukes which bear Edward's subscription, and two of which actually style Edward as king in exile. Norman sources also claim that their dukes supported plans for Edward and Alfred to invade England and recover their kingdom. The prospect that these plans might come to fruition became more realistic when Canute died in 1035, triggering a succession crisis in England between supporters of Harthe Canute and Harold Harefoot, Canute's son by an earlier relationship. Emma naturally supported her son Harthe Canute, but he was too occupied by affairs in Denmark to press his claim in England, and after several months of waiting, Emma appears to have abandoned his cause, switching her hopes to Edward and Alfred, to whom she now made overtures. In 1036, Edward and Alfred crossed the Channel with armed retinues. Edward was confronted by hostile English forces at Southampton and made a hasty retreat to Normandy. But Alfred was less fortunate. He was captured at Guildford by Earl Godwinner, an Englishman who'd become the most powerful magnate in Canute's regime, and Alfred was horrifically blinded, dying shortly afterwards. Back in exile, Edward must have awaited eagerly for news as events unfolded rapidly. In 1037, Harold Harefoot was accepted as king throughout England, and Emma was forced into exile in Flanders. Then, in 1040, Harold died, and Harthe Canute seized his opportunity to become crowned King of England, with his mother Emma at his side. Their regime proved deeply unpopular, and it was perhaps for this reason that a remarkable decision was made to invite Edward back from Normandy. In 1041, Edward duly came to England and was sworn in as king, creating a precarious triumvirate. Then, on the 8th of June, 1042, Harthacnut suddenly died from a seizure, and, according to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, all the people chose Edward as king in London. Edward's odyssey from child exile to middle-aged king was over. Almost all the nobility had collaborated with and profited from the Anglo-Danish regime that had kept Edward in exile, and some of them, Emma and Godwin in particular, must have wondered anxiously if, when, and how Edward might choose to exact revenge. In the event, Edward decided to play one off against the other, forming a pragmatic alliance with Godwin to strengthen his hand against his mother. He accepted the gift of a magnificently furnished warship proffered apologetically by Godwin, and in 1043 he marched an army to Winchester to deal with Emma. With measured understatement, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle records that she was arrested and her treasures seized because she had formerly been very hard to the king, her son. Emma was allowed to stay in Winchester, but her political eclipse was complete by 1045, when Edward married Godwin's daughter, Edith. Edward had succeeded in ridding himself of one queen, but only by marrying another. In the years that followed, relations between Edward and his in-laws became increasingly strained. Godwin suffered high-profile reverses at court, and Edward had begun planting his own men, including friends from Normandy, into positions of authority, thereby undermining Godwin's preeminence. Worst of all, Edward's marriage failed to produce an heir. In 1051, the tension burst. Godwin and his sons collected armies and marched them against the king. Edward responded by mobilising the earldoms of Mercia and Northumbria. Civil war must have seemed imminent, but at a critical moment some of Godwin's thanes defected to the king's side, and he was compelled to escape into exile with all of his family, except Edith, whom Edward dispatched to a nunnery. In need of allies, Edward invited Duke William of Normandy to England, and, according to Norman sources, designated him as his successor. But Edward's moment of triumph proved short-lived. In September 1052, Godwin and his sons mobilised a fleet and sailed up the Thames unopposed. Edward was compelled to restore Godwin and his sons to their earldoms, and Edith to his court. Once more, a sudden death then came to his rescue. On Easter Monday 1053, Godwin suffered a fatal seizure. Liberated at last from Godwin's yoke, Edward began to express himself more freely. The king's coins, then the most powerful medium of symbolic communication, now abandoned the images used by the Anglo-Danish kings, and began to style Edward as a warrior king, and later as an imperial ruler, emulating German and Byzantine styles. Edward also began to build a magnificent new church at Westminster, on the same blueprint as one being built at Jumièges in Normandy, and on a scale intended to rival the great cathedral recently built by the German emperor at Speyer. Edward was conspicuously breaking the Anglo-Scandinavian cultural and political axis on which England had been aligned since 1016. He was also scheming new plans for the succession. In 1054, Edward sent the Archbishop of York to Germany to make arrangements to recall his namesake cousin, who had also escaped into exile shortly after Canute's conquest. Edward the Exile duly journeyed with his young family to England in 1057, but died in mysterious circumstances before reaching the king's court. His son Edgar was now the last legitimate representative of the English ruling dynasty, and it's probable that Edward planned to groom him as his successor. But Edgar was only about 5 years old and had formidable opponents. For by 1058, no fewer than four of Godwin's sons, Harold, Tostig, Leofwina and Gyrth, commanded earldoms in England, and Edward seems to have been content for them to dominate the political scene. Unsurprisingly, Edgar was sidelined, and Harold and Tostig began to eye the throne. Harold's chance came in 1065, when a rebellion in Northumbria forced Tostig out of office. Edward ordered Harold to mobilise an army to confront the rebels, but Harold refused to do so, leaving Edward powerless to protect Tostig, who escaped into exile. This episode appears to have broken Edward's spirit, and in the closing weeks of 1065, he suffered a series of fatal seizures. From his deathbed, he authorised the consecration of the Church of Westminster, and according to certain partisan sources, he designated Harold as his successor. Edward died on the 5th of January 1066 and was buried at Westminster the following day, and a few hours later, Harold was crowned king in the same church. The problem was that Edward had left two of the most powerful generals in Northern Europe convinced of their right to succeed him. 10 months later, that contest reached its inexorable conclusion. Armies led by King Harold and Duke William of Normandy confronted one another at Hastings. The English were defeated and Harold was killed, and the path lay open for William to be crowned King of England on Christmas Day 1066 in Westminster Abbey, just a few feet away from Edward's tomb. Edward managed to achieve a remarkable amount from that tomb. This was largely due to the ingenuity of his widow. Edith needed an account of events which would absolve her from responsibility for failing to produce an heir for Edward, and generate respect for the dead king, which would protect her by association. The anonymous author achieved this with Clinton-like dexterity. He used an ambiguous Latin word to describe Edward's conjugal relations with Edith, Caelebs, which could mean either chaste, that is, faithful within a relationship, or celibate. So, without actually lying, the author managed to bestow upon Edward one of the crucial qualities of sanctity, virginity. He also sprinkled the work with hints that Edward possessed other saintly qualities, good character, devotion to God, and the power to work miracles. The task of making Edward's sanctity official proved harder, but the monks of Westminster were persistent. In 1138, they published a revised life of Edward, adding many new miracles to the original list. And eventually, on the 7th of February 1161, Pope Alexander III was persuaded to issue a bull of canonization. This made it official. King Edward had become Saint Edward, the Confessor. From then, it was only a matter of time before an English king would be drawn to his cult. And that happened in the 1230s, when King Henry III adopted him as his patron saint. To celebrate this, Henry spent much of his reign demolishing Edward's church and replacing it with a new one, our Westminster Abbey, much loved by the nation and known throughout the world as a focal point of British royal ceremony. What sort of person was Edward? He seems to have been a survivor, determined, resourceful, and persistent. He was certainly healthy, active, and loved hunting, and there's no reason to doubt that his piety was genuine. Domesday Book reveals that his kingdom was wealthy and effectively governed, that Edward himself was rich, and that he controlled abundant sources of patronage. His reign was peaceful, and he caused his kingdom to become more cosmopolitan, more closely aligned with the continent. But Edward was surely damaged by childhood abandonment. His attitude towards women is ambiguous in the historical record, perhaps reflecting genuine ambiguity in his emotional makeup. Edward was also cautious and lacked martial vigour. He preferred to send earls to fight on his behalf than to command armies in person. There was something of the Neville Chamberlain about Edward. He preferred diplomacy to conflict, but ended up adopting a policy that led to war. Such complexities and contradictions make Edward seem persuasively human, not saintly. All the same, his cult proved immensely powerful. Although his life was shaped by, and partly caused, national humiliation and defeat, Edward the Confessor eventually became a lasting source of national reverence and pride. And to that extent, it will be idle to deny that his powers were indeed miraculous.